To begin.
Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. The first episode back in the new year, 2024. And we're starting it off with Roberto Camacho. What's up, man?
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dude, thank you for making the drive. We're just talking right now. Again, you're coming out of San Diego. That's your home base out there. And the fact that you made it out here to Montebello, to LA, it's like, dude, thank you for making the trek out to be on the show.
Oh, absolutely. It's a pleasure to be out here. You know, I'm up here normally every couple of months. So it's always nice to make a trek up north from the 619.
Well, I mean, for our listeners, like, give me a little bit of background. I know you're a journalist. You've been doing the work for the last couple of years. And I feel like you've really been trying to put out a message of empowerment and just education and knowledge out to the people, you know, wherever they can get this. And it's one of the reasons why I was like, you know what, I want to have you on the show. I kind of want to dissect your brain and kind of go from there.
Yeah, of course. So I'm a race and social justice reporter, which it's kind of a nebulous and broad topic. But specifically, I would say my work tends to go around police reform, criminal justice reform, immigration, education, the industrial military complex, and of course, Chicano and like Latino-centric issues. So it's a very broad myriad of issues, but I think that there's kind of a central theme of empowerment.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those, a lot of those themes are something that if you look back even the last, you know, up to, let's say 50 years, it's something that's a recurring thing even now, again, 2024. We're still seeing issues with like police reform, and we're still seeing issues with the silencing of people or anything that consists of just being put in a position where we're feeling like we still got to be on the defense.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I always tell people that these issues, you know, they're not new. If anything, they're throwback, because you could look back to, you said 50 years with police brutality. Well, then look at Ruben Salazar in 1970. Look at COINTELPRO, you know, with the silencing of not just journalists, but activists as well, you know. So what we're seeing is not something new. It is just it's the same issues dressed up in 21st century garb. And I think that through my journalism, I like to address those issues and let people know that, you know, we have been here before and we have to update our tactics for a new digital age that we're now in.
And now, when you got started, like, when was that exactly? I know you started, you went to Arizona for university, right?
Yes, I did. So I did my schooling, actually, through their online program. So shout out to Arizona State's online program while I was working here in San Diego. But yeah, I went to the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. It's a wonderful program. I got to study with some of the greatest professors and journalists in the field. The way I got into journalism, though, is I kind of got into it in a very roundabout way. A lot of people, you know, I wasn't the kind of person like, oh, I was in the school newspaper in high school, or I wasn't running around with a pencil as a kid, you know, like trying to take people's, you know, notes or, you know, interview them, you know. Like, I got into it very late in life, actually. And the way I did it is, like, I got into journalism really more through activism, which is kind of reversed. I think most people start off as journalists and then they end up becoming activists because of that. And I kind of got into it really initially was covering like what we call citizen journalism. I was just going out with my phone and, you know, and covering events. And it really started with the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, back in the early 2010s. I was like just fresh into community college at that time. And then from there, it grew into covering stuff, particularly after Ferguson with the murder of Mike Brown, covering those. But like, it really came to a head in 2016. There was an event in El Cajon, which is like a suburb to the east of San Diego. It's about a 15-minute drive. That's where I actually grew up in. And there was a man named Alfred Alango, who was an Ugandan refugee who was suffering a mental health crisis. And he was, you know, in the parking lot of this Mexican food restaurant, you know, just, you know, having a mental breakdown. And his sister called the, you know, police, you know, like three times that, you know, my brother is going through a mental health crisis, you know, please send an ambulance. Not the police, send an ambulance. They wanted to send a PERT team. And after about an hour, El Cajon PD rolls up, and they within 30 seconds of the encounter, they shoot him on the spot. One cop, you know, deploys a taser, other one shoots him right then and there. and he ends up dying. And there's a huge uproar because this particular officer had a long history of abuse and sexual harassment, within the department against other female officers, not even, against quote unquote civilians. And this officer was, his punishment was he wasn't fired. He was demoted from being a sergeant to just, regular beat cop. But this is something that local media was not covering at the time. This is something that, like, if you or I or a teacher or a doctor was sexually harassing, a fellow coworker, they'd be gone. On the spot, right then and there. But because this cop wasn't fired, he ended up murdering a man in the midst of a mental health crisis. And I remember being very frustrated because on top of the local media not covering this, those of us who are on the ground covering or, people protesting, we're getting tear gassed, we're getting shot with rubber bullets, having flash grenades being shot at us. And keep in mind, this happened in September of 2016. So it's at the height of the presidential election. Mm-hmm. There's already been three or four other major high profile police shootings over the summer too, that have already taken the national attention of this issue. And I'm going thinking to myself, no one is going to know what's going to happen here. The police are going to beat the shit out of us. And nobody's going to care because it's happening in a place that no one knows about or cares about. So that's when I started at the suggestion of a friend, that's when I started Step Off Magazine, because I was doing all this citizen journalism. I was posting it to Facebook, putting stuff on Twitter. And my friend said, you know what? You create and you write really beautiful compositions on Facebook, but what they are, they're rants. They're Facebook rants. They're very nice sounding and very well composed rants, but they're still just rants. And the only people that are going to see it are going to be your friends who share it and maybe a couple of the people that maybe share from there. So with the help of some other people, I created this website, started doing my own freelance journalism. And from there, I slowly but surely started branching out and then freelancing for other publications other than my own. So that's a slightly abridged version of the origin story behind how I got into it.
Dude, well, that's powerful because, I mean, just to touch on a few things there, like, you're in San Diego, I'm out here in Southeast LA, but there's still these recurring things, again, that are going on no matter how far we are. And it's also happening to the people of color in the community. So you see, once you zoom out of your location, you start seeing, again, this is a broader thing all across. Secondly, like, the fact that you took action, right? Like, you took the action to start putting this information out there for everybody, for the public. That takes a lot because, anybody can think of an idea or like, hey, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, but you never materialize it, right? It never becomes something tangible. But the fact that you actually took that emotion, that frustration, those emotions that you had, and you built something out, it's going to allow anybody else who's feeling that same way, and that empowers people.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like in this day of age, we have more tools than ever to make our voices heard. And I think that's important that we take it upon ourselves to build these platforms to elevate not just our own voices, but those in our community who, maybe don't have the means or don't have the know-how to put this together, but they still have a voice. Mm-hmm. And I feel like as journalists, whether you work for a big publication or whether you're just a citizen journalist going out doing freelance stuff, it's important that we uplift these voices and give them a platform. Because one thing I never like is sometimes journalists will say, they want to be a voice for the voiceless. Well, the voice, everyone has a voice. They don't need someone to be a voice for them. What they need is a platform. Mm-hmm. And it's our job to be that platform for them, to share their experiences, to share the injustices that they have suffered, that quite frankly, our communities have been suffering for, hundreds of years sometimes, whether it's here in San Diego or whether it's here in Los Angeles or all the way across the country, New York, Chicago, Miami. I mean, like, you go to all these different cities and the issues, they may look and sound slightly different, but at the end of the day, you're going to see far more commonalities than differences.
Yeah, exactly. And then you mentioned about making the platform, like the platform, you're allowing people's narratives to be told. And again, when somebody listens to it, that's been in the same position, they're able to be like, damn, I feel empathy or sympathy towards anybody around me, you know, and that allows you to grow into, first of all, a well-rounded person, right? Because that's, mm-hmm. I think that's the only way sometimes that we can take action without having to do a huge thing. And like, just start making changes within yourself, like start opening up to different things and, you know, being open to knowledge. And that's going to change a lot real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you can't change something until you've identified what the problem is. And there's so many people that they feel overwhelmed. They feel so overwhelmed that they don't even know where to start with some of these issues, because let's get real, you know, some of these issues, they are very, very complicated and very hard issues that have been going on for a long time, you know, and they weren't created in a day and they're not going to be solved in a day. But you take an article, you break it down, you present it in a way that's digestible, that people can understand, then it doesn't seem so insurmountable.
Yeah.
And then they realize how it affects them and what they could do different in their community. You know, because maybe something like police reform on a grand scale seems insurmountable. Mm-hmm. Well, then break it down. Well, who's the one that appoints the chief of police in most cities? It's the mayor. Well, who normally has the most, who normally has to say the fire police mm-hmm. in a city? It's the mayor, or it's the city council. Well, who votes in the mayor? Who votes in city mm-hmm. council? These people just aren't appointed. They're not kings. It's not a monarchy. It comes from us. But we have to be able to know. People have to know that, though.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know how these systems work, you know. And you have to know how the system works and how the tools of the oppressor work if you want to use it against them. You know, you have to be smarter. You have to be two steps ahead in this. And I feel like one of the best ways to, you know, to be ahead is if we're educated, like you said, breaking down all those issues.
Yeah, and sometimes it's a little scary. Like, I can only speak from my experiences and the experiences I saw my parents have. But like, even for like, let's say my mom, for something so simple as getting like a driver license in California, you know, up until a point, it was, I think, when Arnold Schwarzenegger was mayor governor. He passed a thing where nobody can get licenses or something. And it wasn't until recently where they can, you know, it's like a modified one, but license, no, regardless. My mom's still scared of getting one, you know, like she's paranoid about like getting in the database. Like, mm-hmm. hey, they're going to know, like, no, they're going to know I'm not like documented and stuff. And I feel like that can be expanded to other people maybe, you know, that I'm sure they feel in similar ways that they feel like they don't want to get involved with anything that has to do with local government or just government in general. And it kind of makes them not want to be involved, hence not wanting to be involved in their communities for change.
You know, absolutely. You know, and like, and that fear is real. You know, there are lots of people from a myriad of different marginalized groups and identities who are fearful of taking part because, like you said, there may be some kind of repercussion or targeting. There's a lot of people who also are just simply, maybe they aren't even at risk, but they're intimidated. Mm-hmm. And they're so intimidated that they would rather just, you know what, I don't know anything about this, I'm not even going to bother it, I'm going to leave it to somebody else.
Yeah.
But the thing is, though, is like, when it comes to these systems, we need to be participants. We can't, because when you're a participant, and when you're not a participant, somebody is going to make a decision for you. They're going to make a decision for you, your family, your community, and a lot of times they're not going to be decisions that are in your best interest. It's going to be in theirs. And that's something that, you know, like, why it's our job to help educate those around us, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, like, you know, like this knowledge doesn't need to be hoarded. You know, like we live in the greatest time where like everybody has these little phone. You can't see me, but, you know, I'm holding up, you know, this little cell phone. Everybody from, you know, my 80-year-old grandmother to a little 5-year-old has these things, you know, so like this knowledge is not just kept away anymore. You know, we can help uplift one another and, not just educate, but lift each other to the top. Because when we all rise together, you know, then we can solve even the most insurmountable obstacles.
Yeah, no, and it's really true. Because, I mean, again, if you go just down to the individual level, like I've mentioned this in the last couple of podcasts, like I've been on this trajectory of just learning about myself, about where my parents come from. And I've been making this connection, and I feel like I've been walking with more pride, you know, of where I'm coming from compared to what, you know, 10 years ago, I was more like, yeah, I'm brown, but I'm light brown, guys, you know, like just, you know, just kind of trying to like disconnect from it. And it was a reality for me. But again, now it's something that I've decided, I've chosen myself to be like, hey, I'm going to make it my own goal to connect to this. And while I'm doing that, just kind of help other people who may be on the same boat again, you know, because somebody out there is sharing the same experience as us right now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I feel like I completely relate to like your experience. I was talking to Jake Prendez. He's a Chicano artist up in Seattle. He has a place up there called La Panda. He was telling me, you know, growing up in a place where, you know, there's not a lot of Chicanos, not a lot of brown folks, not a lot of people of color in general, mm-hmm. in a place like, you know, Seattle, you know, let alone back in the 90s. And he's saying, you know, you got people, they tend to go in one direction when they reach this part where you leave childhood and go into adulthood. And people, they tend to either, they want to completely remove themselves from their culture and their people and assimilate, or they go super into it. Like he said, he became super Chicano, mm-hmm. is what he had, and to use his own words. And I feel like for me, that's something also that happened to me. You know, like I didn't just get into it. Like I went all into it. I started taking Chicano studies when I was in community college. I started reading books on my own. I started talking to my tios who were around, you know, during the Chicano movement in the 60s and 70s. You know, I just like immersed myself in it because there's a certain kind of empowerment that comes when you know where your people have been. Because when you know where you've been, then you know where you're going and where you mm-hmm. don't want to go back to. And I think that, you know, that you said there's an empowerment that comes with knowing that. And it warms my heart to see that there are more people than ever that are coming into contact with this stuff and this history. And it's not necessarily always through academia. You know, sometimes it's through, you know, stuff on Instagram, it's through Twitter, it's through, you know, it's on TikTok now. You got people, you know, making these little, you know, 90 second reels on TikTok, you know, breaking down, you know, the history of the U of W, or, you know, what Ruben Salazar was doing, or Dolores Huerta, you know, and it's incredible.
Yeah, you know, it's really incredible. But I've been thinking about like the way that it's been used also against the people to mark them as radicalized, and using that as like using that as a way to say like, oh, well, this guy's radicalized, like, you know, we got to take him down type of way. And again, it goes back to the whole thing where like, let's say me and you, we're having this conversation, and this conversation for whatever reason goes viral and it empowers like millions of people in terms of, you know, connecting, standing up for what's right.
Yeah.
At what point is our message, just a normal conversation, going to be weaponized against us? And I feel like that nowadays is a little scary, because you would think that you're just trying to do something for the sake of the public good, but it kind of comes back to you, you know?
Yeah, you know, I know what I understand the concern that you bring up, because it's very true. And I think that, like we were talking about earlier, it's important to look at this stuff through a historical context, and that there is no form of resistance that is ever acceptable to the oppressor. Mm-hmm. You and I could have been having this conversation in 1960 and handing out leaflets and pamphlets, and the establishment still would have come down with us on us with an iron fist.
Yeah.
Today, you know, we're not talking just through lectures on campuses or, you know, handing out leaflets at protests. You know, now we're sending out tweets mm-hmm. and we're posting things on Instagram. And of course, you know, now we have the power to reach people on the other side of the globe.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's why you see the establishment coming down so hard on anybody who challenges the status quo. You know, I just saw, you know, today, you know, Sean King got mm-hmm. deplatformed, you know, from Facebook and Instagram, all of his platforms, you know, his own personal one, the North Star, his the Breakdown podcast. And he's just one of several, you know, many other activists, people who speak truth of power, being deplatformed and being targeted by the state. And I think that it's important to realize that, yes, there is always the very real potential for repercussions, mm-hmm. or speaking out against the status quo. But and that's not to downplay the danger of that. I just think it's important for people to realize that, you know, again, we've been here before. It just slightly looks different.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely one of those things that if it comes down to it, though, you know, the repercussions are real. But nonetheless, I think the more powerful thing when this does happen is you start seeing that these things are happening because there's truth to them. And that only is going to make that truth deeper for the people who already believe in it. And if anything, it's just going to anger you and make you more resilient to the things and be more active about it. And that it's just, you're basically just empowering a bunch of more people.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of feel like things can't be done in the dark anymore like they used to, you know. And things back in the day, and when I say back in the day, I'm just talking, you know, 20 years ago, it stayed normally in the community.
Yeah.
Whether it was, you know, corruption at City Hall or maybe somebody was murdered by the police, it might get coverage in the city or maybe even the town over. But normally it'd be covered by local news and the story would die. Maybe if it was something big, you know, you look at cases like Rodney King or Amadou Diallo, and then it goes, well, it wasn't viral back then, but it goes to national news. Well, now everybody's got these little phones. They're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Anybody now has a voice. You know, you and I can record on this podcast. Somebody in Gaza with an internet connection can say, tell the world what's going on because they're being bombed by one of the most corrupt and horrible governments and militaries in the entire world. And they're bringing light to that, you know? And I just think it's powerful to think, you know, how the game has completely changed in bringing light to injustice like this. And like you said, it just, for lack of a better term, it radicalizes more people because, you know, you can't take away knowledge once it's been learned.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, you know, what the state really, that's what really keeps the state up at night. And what they worry about, because you know you can't intimidate people who are not afraid anymore.
Exactly. One of the things that I think about is like, where do we go from here now? You know, if we're in a place with media, with news, right, with journalism, let's say, where again you can't really hide in the dark. If you do, it's only going to be a minute, you know, a short term before it comes out to the light. So where does it go from here? Like, you will think that you will just go with straight truth. Like, you'll just be like, fuck, there's nothing else we can do. We can't lie. So might as well just be full truth. But that doesn't seem like a reality with the way things are going, you know?
You know, like, I kind of feel like that's why everything with social media, it's like anything else. It's a tool. It's a double-edged sword. It all depends on how you look at it and how you use it. You know, you look at something like any tool, look at a hammer. You could use that and you can punch in nails to build a house. You could use a chisel to, you know, make a beautiful statue. But in the wrong hands, you know, you can bash in your neighbor's skull in, do something horrible with it. Same thing with social media. I kind of feel like that's why you see so much disinformation and misinformation out there. You know, there's an entire industry to sowing nothing but discontent and misinformation and, you know, misinforming people. And I think for a while that wasn't the case. It seemed for a while like there was an imbalance, if you will. There were more young people, I think, on social media and people who are more social justice minded. But, you know, I think once the far right kind of got hip, they kind of figured out how to use social media, that's when you get like your post-truth era, your alternative fact era. And I think from here, you know, the goal really should be like teaching not just media literacy, you know, teaching people how to read between the lines, how to you know, kind of fact check their sources. You know, if to tell you honestly, teach the average person to think like a journalist, honestly, is what it's kind of teaching people to do. But I think moving forward, it's going to be inspiring people to action. you know, and to actually make a difference in their community or their city, wherever they may be, because I feel like people are aware now. If you're not aware, then you're not paying attention at this point.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, because it goes back to the whole thing that if you're not feeling angry at what's going on, like, you're, again, you're not really paying attention, because you, it should make you feel a type of way. I mean, hopefully it's the, you know, a way that makes sense for the sake of people in general. But again, the critical thinking part, like, it's hard sometimes to get people to get to that point, you know, and it, sometimes it takes a personal event to happen in your life or something to happen to somebody that you know for you to be like, holy shit, this is real. Like, this is where things get, like, the line's not blurry anymore. Like, you clearly know what's going on with the state government or local powers and how they relate to the community on an individual level. And it's scary. Again, it goes back to the intimidation. Like, you feel scared because if you're thinking about it just on your own, yeah, it feels scary. But, you know, hopefully you can build a community strong enough that can stand on its own. Kind of relating to what I was reading on Chicano Park was, I'm not entirely too sure on the dates, but I know there was like a 12-day sit-in or something. It was like a protest.
Yeah, if you don't mind, you know, yeah. I could break down a little bit of that history. So before I begin, you know, just shout out to the Chicano Park Steering Committee out there in San Diego, who are the stewards of the park and have been so for the past 50 years. And they have maintained the integrity of that space and have provided everything for it. It's not something that the city has done. This is something that the community and the steering committee has done. But yes, in 1970, there was a 12-day occupation of this land that sits under the Coronado Bridge. And this is land that was promised by the city to the community of Logan Heights. It was going to be a public park. And keep in mind, this is after the 5 freeway was built through the neighborhood. It split the neighborhood in two, like a cleaver. And thousands of people were displaced. People lost their homes. They lost their business. The neighborhood was split into two. Add insult to injury, a couple years later, they build the Coronado Bridge right through there. And you have this vacant piece of land that the people wanted as a public park. Well, then come to find out, people discover, what are they building there? They're not building a park. They want to build the highway, a California Highway Patrol substation in one of the most overly policed parts of the city. Back in 1970, people were outraged. So you have a coalition of Brown Berets, Mecha students, you know, college students, just concerned citizens from the neighborhood. And they staged a 12-day militant but peaceful occupation, and eventually the city relented and they ceded that piece of land to the community, and it is now what we know as Chicano Park. And over the past 50 years, they have been adding murals to that space. It's now the largest collection of murals in the outdoor murals in the entire world. It is it's recognized as a U.S. National Historic Monument, and now they have a whole museum dedicated to the park as well. It just celebrated its first year anniversary back in October. And people from all over the world now can come and they can see that history right there in the museum. You don't just got to go and hope that, you know, one of the muralists or one of the people there are giving a tour.
Damn. You know, it goes back to the thing I wanted to say with this whole subject was that I feel like back in that time, I mean, if you take a look at the times, of course, the whole social justice was completely different too. But I feel like there's not a lot of activity a lot with the youth nowadays, or at least in a way where we can all collectively come together for something, you know? And I don't know if that's on purpose, like it's made that way to kind of deter us from, you know, making something happen. Or if it's just like an uninterest because we don't know the information. Like I wasn't even aware of the Chicano Park again until I mentioned to you earlier when I saw photos, and I was like, I thought that was East LA. But knowing the history, once I, you know, started doing the research, I was like, holy shit, this is a place that represents that Chicano, you know? But again, I didn't have that information. And I feel like sometimes people, unless they come across it, they're not gonna know.
You know, I don't think it's a mistake that this kind of history is kept from us, because when I was in high school, you know, I'm going to date myself now, like 18 years ago, I remember looking at my history book and there was like maybe two pages of like the Chicano movement. It was, and like one of those pages was completely on like Cesar Chavez and like the farm worker union movement. You know, it wasn't until I went to college that I started, you know, like taking Chicano studies classes and learning more about this. And I was just fortunate that, you know, I had family members who were youth at that time who were, you know, actually involved. Mm-hmm. But it's no mistake that you have places like Arizona. Like 10 years ago, they banned Chicano studies out there, you know, like outright. They did not want students learning about it, and they had to take it all the way up to like the highest court to get to the fight for that. And that's another thing too. It wasn't just give it to them. People had to fight to get that back. And I don't think it's a mistake that that kind of militant history is downplayed, or even the fact that, you know, the term Chicano has fallen out of favor. I think in due in large part because, you know, it's not just a social label. It is a definedly political identifier, you know, because anybody can be a Latino, you know, or anybody can be, you know, someone of, you know, Mexican descent. Yeah. You have to declare yourself to be a Chicano. It is a social and political identifier.
Damn, that's beautiful, man. That's what, again, you know, I've, like I said earlier, I've talked about this on the podcast before, where I've had a trouble associating myself with the word Chicano because I've felt like I haven't done no work to earn that, you know, and that's where I get like this weird, like, am I not, should I, am I a poser? Like, it feels weird, you know, but it comes down to the point where you know you're one when you take it upon yourself to take the time to learn, to educate yourself, to go out of your way to find out more information and to, again, give out that information back to people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when you feel like you can, I mean, I'm not the one who says like, hey, these are the rules, but I'm saying that's how I felt. Like I felt like at this point I can more relate to it because I feel like I'm at least having conversations that will get people curious enough.
You know, I'm glad that you bring that point up because I think that it is a common experience amongst people who consider themselves Chicano to not feel like they completely fit into one box. You know, it's like the saying goes, not from here, not from there. Or if you've ever seen the movie Selena, when they say, you know, you have to be more Mexican than the Mexicans and more American than the Americans. And it's a draining experience to not completely fit into, like, you know, anyone's quote unquote box. But, and like you said, you know, like you get imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, I don't think that, that's how they rob us of our history, because they make you feel like, you know, well, I can't identify with this because, you know, I didn't go through the struggle, or I didn't earn this.
Yeah.
But, you know, but like, you know, like, we didn't have people like shed like literal sweat, blood and tears and literally give their lives, you know, so, you know, other people that, you know, like we haven't even met make us feel like, you know, we are not entitled, you know, to like feeling like a belonging, you know, with our, and a connection with our own people's history. And, you know, we can't let that intimidate us. I get it. I get the struggle of self-discovery and reconnecting with one's history. But I think that that's why it's important for people like you and I to use these platforms to let people know that other people are not alone, mm-hmm. and that other people are going through the same thing and have gone through the same thing.
Yeah. And I think it's also really important to hear it from people who are just normal people, because sometimes you go into media outlets and you're reading this language and you're like, or just legal language, it's confusing, you know, unless you know the terms, the terminology, you're like, what? And you can easily kind of just like disconnect from it. Mm-hmm. But I think when you're able to give information to people that's, again, digestible, that they can read and really get the point of it, they're more likely to take the action rather than just being afraid of it.
You know, it kind of reminds me a lot of times with like the goal in journalism, you know, when you write, you don't want to dumb it down, but you're also not writing a collegiate paper either. You know, you have to remember that, you know, most people read, I think there's a study out there that says most people read at like a second grade level. Damn. And the thing is, you know, you can't, you can't meet people where you want them. You need to meet them where they're at, mm-hmm. which means, you know, you have to give people the information in like these little bite-sized digestible, portions. And I think that that's important, you know, like it's, you know, we have to be patient with one another because mm-hmm. no one person was born knowing everything. You and I, everyone else, we learned something. We were taught by somebody, you know, we just didn't wake up one day and knew everything, So I think it's important that we give people, like you said, that time and grace to learn and reconnect. And like, again, remember, we're all on the same team.
Yeah.
You know, and also don't gatekeep. There's a lot of people out there that like to gatekeep knowledge, you know, like we have to be comfortable being teachers and wearing lots of hats. Be a teacher, be an activist, be a journalist, you know, just be a good friend. You know, maybe you're just talking amongst your homies, you know. But, you know, bring that knowledge and inject it into conversations and like your everyday life.
It kind of reminds me of this book. I hope I pronounce it right. The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. It was basically the concept of the book was just, if you want to teach people, you have to come down to the level. You have to allow yourself to become the student while being the teacher at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that allows you to mold yourself and them. And, you know, that's real growth. That's real education.
And I think also it's important, you know, give people credit where credit is due. You know, we look at the works of Marx or Lenin. You know, we look at the Russian Revolution. You know, people were passing out pamphlets to factory workers to overthrow the Tsar.
Yeah.
You know, these are people who were, if they weren't illiterate, you know, again, they read at a grade school age level. But if, you know, people were able to organize and do revolution back then, that we can certainly do it now in the 21st century when we got phones and televisions and, you know, we're on social media platforms, you know. So is it difficult? Yes. But is it doable? Absolutely.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it kind of relates to what I said earlier. It's like, if we had these things going on, the last big protest, that's not true. Sorry. I've been to some recently too, but the one that made an impact on me when I was a little kid was one of my first ones was when I think it was the immigration of 2005 or 2004 or something like that. I was in high school. Mm-hmm. Everybody was like, walk out, walk out.
Yep.
Everybody started walking out. That was the last time I ever saw a walkout in the last, after my high school, my school age. I haven't seen a real walkout in that type of sense, at least here. But it's like, dude, what happened, you know?
I will say, because you and I are the same, around the same age, there are people, the kids are organizing walkouts. I have seen stuff on social media, on Twitter, and Facebook, in relation to like George Floyd and the modern, what I will call the third wave of civil rights movements. Mm-hmm. I think that at the time when we were growing up or coming of age, social movements had kind of hit an all-time low. I think that the anti-war movement was all but dead at that moment. You know, the Iraq war was at its height. Yeah. And, you know, of course, everyone was whipped up in post 9/11 fever. And even if you did oppose the war, you were castigated for it. You know, civil rights, you know, forget it. You know, that wasn't being addressed, like you said, you know, just immigration at that time. That's really the only one. But all those issues, though, that we're addressing now, they were still happening back then.
Yeah.
But what happened? But they weren't being addressed. And it's like when you build up pressure in a bottle, it builds up and it builds up and it builds up and it builds up until eventually it bursts.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. That's what we're seeing now, you know. So over the past 10 or 15 years, all these issues being neglected because we were putting expenses, fighting several other wars across the world overseas. And now finally it's come to a head because we haven't been focusing on those issues that are happening here. You know, that's why everyone feels like everything's happening all at once, mm-hmm. you know, because all those issues have been ignored for decades.
Yeah. And it's crazy because it feels like a collective thing that everybody feels that pressure, like that tension, like, you know, around you, you know,
because we've been living in it, you know, you know, like facts, everyone feels it because that's what we have been experiencing, you know. And I feel like what makes it even worse is the fact that you still got people that want to pretend like there's nothing going on. For real. There's nothing. Yeah. Like everything, it's like the meme. If you've ever seen the person drinking coffee and the house is on fire, it's like, this is fine.
Yeah. The little dog.
Exactly. The dog. Yeah. You know, but everything has kind of come to a head, you know, so like I am glad that, and I think in no small part, that we see the rise of these modern day civil rights movements with the proliferation of social media and, you know, cell phones. And, you know, people are able to communicate more than ever before, because like back then, you know, 2005, 2006, what do we have? MySpace, yeah, AOL, MySpace. AOL Messenger, you yeah. know, ain't nobody was organizing over MySpace. You yeah. know what was going on the wall saying, yeah, we're going to march today, you know. Yeah. They were putting people in your top five, you know. And if you get that, then you're old, you know.
I know. For real, they're probably like, yeah, this guy's validating my experience in MySpace.
All these geriatric millennials listening right now. I know. Like us.
No, but I mean, yeah, I mean, we were at the tip of it, you know, that we saw it get started, and I feel like now it's being used to mobilize a lot of other stuff too. Even if it's not like in like physical protests, it's still like, hey, let's all share this message, trying to get this point across, right? And I feel like done within the right form, I guess, you can get real information out rather than just like, again, going to the whole fake news and alternative mm-hmm. stuff. You can actually get information out real quick.
Yeah. It is easier now than ever, I think, to organize people. But the thing is that, like, you are in a sea of voices. Because the double-edged sword to social media and online organizing is that everybody has a voice, which is amazing. But the downside is everybody has a voice. So you have yeah. to, you know, compete in a sea of people. And you have to compete, you know, not just with people, but with influencers yeah. and, you know, people selling stuff on Instagram and Facebook. You have to deal with people that make a living being professional clowns mm-hmm. on this stuff,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, trying to beat the algorithm. They're going to do whatever it needs to him.
Yeah, you know, and it's hard. And believe me, as somebody who works in print media and is trying to get people to read on social media, it's like yanking teeth. So yeah. I get it. I get the difficulty of, you know, doing that organizing.
What do you see yourself doing like in the next couple of years? Let's say obviously you're going to continue pursuing journalism and the stuff with your magazine, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In the near future, you know, like I really do hope to be, I would like to, if I'm lucky enough, you know, be doing journalism full time. Unfortunately, this is a field that is constantly changing. Mm-hmm. News entities are constantly closing down. People are being laid off. Newspapers are being bought out outright and just being shut down, you know, so it's definitely not a field, I think, that is for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
But I think that the people who have their heart and minds in the right places will make it happen. And I would love to keep that going for myself, to be doing it full time as a professional journalist. I would love to keep on doing Step Off as long as I can. We have a podcast that we've been doing on there for the past almost 8 years now.
Damn. You know,
so we got lots of good hip-hop artists on there, lots of great activists that we get on there, poets and visual artists as well. So as long as I can keep that up, it's a blessing, because, you know, this is another thing that I don't make any money off of doing stuff with Step Off. That right there is a labor of love on my part. So being able to talk to the artist and talk to the people there, I would love to keep that going.
Yeah, and then there's something special about that. When you're doing something out of love, again, it's cool because it drives you. And I was just talking to Mirage earlier about it. Like it keeps you fresh, like being able to be around creatives or people who are doing stuff to move a movement or something, you know, like it fulfills another part of your human existence.
Yeah, you know, I feel like it's fulfilling, you know, when you're doing something not because you need to make content or you need to like hit a certain monthly quota. Mm-hmm. Or you don't have someone that's breathing down your neck because they want something out. You're doing it for the love of it, and it's something that you care and you're putting all of your passion into. And also, you know, like it brings you in contact with a lot of amazing people.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's a lot of people that we come in contact now through these digital means that otherwise we probably would have never met 20 years ago.
Exactly.
So it really is a beautiful thing, you know, and it brings me a lot of joy, you know, especially as somebody that covers things that I'll just say are not the happiest topics to cover. Mm-hmm. It is nice to be able to kind of, you know, to cover some, I guess what I'll call fun things, whether it's the artist or the musicians and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, you got to keep it balanced too. Otherwise, you're going to like get too dark, you know, go Batman mode, like all the darks and shit.
And that's the hard part as a journalist. Striking that balance is very difficult because, unfortunately, like a lot of people, we don't necessarily get the luxury of being able to just turn it off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, you come faced with the reality of things. And again, when you're seeing that, it's, you know, kind of like the stuff that we're seeing right now with Palestine. It's, you see it, but you can't turn it off. You know it's still happening in the background. And it's, man, they're difficult times, dude. And anything we can do to kind of just bring awareness to that is a step.
You know, we owe it to the Palestinian people to uplift the injustice and the plight that we're facing. Because for those of you listening that remember back 10 years ago in Ferguson, when the Ferguson PD was macing people and dousing them with tear gas, who were the first people on Twitter that were giving them advice how to treat those? It was people in Palestine. It was people in the West Bank. It was people in Gaza. People in Palestine were some of the most ardent and supportive people, the Black Lives Matter movement and against police brutality here in this country. Because who does most of the training for U.S. police?
Mm-hmm.
There are hundreds of police departments that go all the way to Israel to learn and train with the IDF. And then they come back and they import those same brutal tactics here in the States that they propagate against Black and brown communities. So I think that it's important to bring full circle that all of our struggles as marginalized people are connected, even if we don't realize it or it doesn't seem apparent, because eventually everything that happens to another group is going to happen to us. Because these places that the United States has a vested interest in are testing grounds. Everything that they do over there, they'll bring back here. What happened in Iraq? It was one of the most urban and disastrous conflicts of the 21st century. And as soon as that conflict wrapped up, they sent all of that military gear back here to the States. Think about it. Before Iraq, how many police departments do you see have M16s? How many police departments did you see have drones? How many police departments you see at MRAPs? Now all of them have it. You could go to a small town in the middle of Ohio and they got militarized weapons like that. What are they gonna do? I mean, like they got like two cops, but they have all this military weaponry. They got like Barney Fife as the police chief. But to bring it back full circle, it's important to remember that even though these conflicts may seem far and away and removed from us, they're really not. And as people from marginalized communities, we have not just an obligation, but a duty to uplift their stories and to not just go about our everyday lives and pretend like nothing's happening. Because that's what the system wants us to do. They want us to act like nothing's wrong. They want us to not care. They want us to be indifferent. We can't happen. We can't let that happen. That's why it's our job to resist in even the most mundane ways.
Mm-hmm.
Boycott a company like Starbucks that, you know, gives money to the IDF. Boycott any of these companies that they import their fruit and vegetables from Israel. You know, boycott these companies like Amazon that have contracts that do that have weapons contracts with the IDF as well. You know, there's lots of ways that we could disrupt the system.
Dude, thank you for the powerful conversation. I really do hope that anybody listening to these type of conversations or anything that they read from you or anything that you put out as well, it allows them to just be curious enough to start digging, you know, because I think that's what it starts with. You just got to hear something, you got to see a message and be like, wait a second, this is what I'm connecting with. And just you gotta chase that feeling. But thank you for the time, Roberto. It was an honor, man.
Of course, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For people to find your what you've written, any articles or of your work, where can they find you?
Yeah, so if you want access all of my writing, you can follow me on social media. It's all posted up there. It's all the same across every single platform. It's Rob_Camacho, C-A-M-A-C-H-O _SD. And that's going to be the same for Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, all that good stuff. And then if you want to listen to my podcast, that is Step Off Radio. And that's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and every other major podcast platform out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, dude, thank you so much for making the time again. And I hope you get home safely and enjoy 2024, man.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Good night, everybody. Peace out.
Sé quién soy frente al espejo.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Me robo la corona y después desaparezco.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Cantinero. Otra para mis caballeros, huevos de acero. Si crees que estamos jugando juegos, callejero, pintando calles, tenés y techos, grafitero. El que quieren de carcelero, si me entrego. Perdóname, señor gobierno, no entiendo. Mi dialecto no habla puerco, pa' ser honesto. El desrespeto es lo que detesto. We on the West Coast, it's how we reto.
Enemigos de este cuento, digo, putazos por respeto. Tropen de comida, lo en el espejo, se da cierto lo que siento. Escalofrío, el frío viento, traen envidia a mi vida por ser un prieto. Yo te mando hasta el infierno, manota más que nunca pierdo. Cargo fiero, listo pa' sacar el miedo, mi alma será eterno. Viven en el frío invierno, con esta rola tal vez los entierro, putos perros.
Gano este dinero, me dicen cómo haces eso.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Amo mi familia, con todo yo los protejo.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Con respeto sé quién soy frente al espejo.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Me robo la corona y después desaparezco.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Este morro nunca aprendió, pues ya ni modo. El padre lo trato como demonio. Cuando nació llegó la lluvia y los terremotos. Estrella pero no lo ven con telescopio. Osa mayor con el cuarto oscuro. Está cabrón cuando salen juntos. Cada canción pintamos muros con la visión de cambiar el mundo.
Traje la lumbre, terminamos instrumentos por costumbre. Estamos conectados como cables al enchufe. Algo de nada, encuentro oro en la casa. Las buenas por las malas, mis letras son como balas. Y descubres tu razón por existir. Yo te invito, ven a vivir. Esta cena va a convivir lunes a lunes. Me la llevo en el cielo. Piensan que vengo a robarles todo y eso les da miedo.
Gano este dinero, me dicen cómo haces eso.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Amo a mi familia, con todo yo los protejo.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Siempre con respeto sé quién soy frente al espejo.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Me robo la corona y después desaparezco.
Me ven con la cara de bandolero.
Otra para mis caballeros.
Tiro putazos por respeto.
Las buenas por las malas, mi como balas.
Quitamos muro, cuarto oscuro.